Hello, welcome to Foreign Entanglements. I'm Matt Duss. I'm with the Foundation for Middle East Peace. And with me today, for the first time on Blogging Heads, is Amir Tibon. He's a diplomatic correspondent with Walla News in Israel, speaking with me from Tel Aviv. How are you this afternoon, Amir?
I'm okay, Matt. Hoping that the ceasefire that we've been seeing here for the last almost 48 hours will hold. It's supposed to end tomorrow, and we're all hoping that it won't, that there will be a way to prolong it.
Yeah, so let's just take a moment before we move to the article, which I'll introduce. Why don't we just take a moment? We're speaking on Thursday. It's late morning here in D.C., the afternoon in Israel. In Cairo right now, various parties, the Egyptians, are hosting negotiations over a longer-term ceasefire. So just give me your take. We spoke earlier, and you're unfortunately a bit skeptical that the ceasefire will hold. So just give me your take on where things stand right now.
Well, actually, you know, the negotiations supposedly are between Israel and the Palestinian delegation that includes the Palestinian Authority and also Hamas. But actually, the real negotiation is between Hamas and the Egyptian government, because Hamas wants Egypt to open the border crossing between Egypt and the Gaza Strip. Near Rafah, and the Egyptians are not very enthusiastic about doing it, and that seems to be the biggest problem right now. That's the biggest feud, and Hamas is shooting rockets at Israel, but in a way it's aiming at Egypt. They want the Egyptians to, you know, to break the siege over Gaza, to open the Rafah crossing, and the Egyptians don't really want to do it, and that seems to be the biggest problem in Cairo right now. And I hope there will be a way to solve it by tomorrow, because if not, then in less than 24 hours, we'll have the renewal of the rockets towards Israel and the Israeli attacks in Gaza, and the whole mess will start again.
Right. I mean, so what's the Egyptians' biggest, you know, issue here with opening Rafah?
Well, this goes back to the Egyptian inner war, you know, between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas being an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, basically the organization's branch in Palestine, specifically in Gaza. And, you know, the Egyptians don't want a free flow of Hamas military people into Egypt. They think that they will be using the border crossing to infiltrate Egypt and, you know, encourage terrorism and encourage the Muslim Brotherhood's activities against the military government led by General Sisi. And that's a big problem. And also, I think the Egyptians are saying, if we do open the Rafah crossing under any restrictive circumstances, then we want the control of the crossing to be handed over to the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah. And that's kind of a humiliation for Hamas, because there's a big feud between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. So basically, as an Israeli, I feel like you know, we've been thrown into this inner Arab conflict, which is very complicated to solve, and it will be very hard to see how there is some kind of a big solution to all of this without each of the side making serious concessions.
Right. I mean, we've got the Sisi government right now in Egypt, which is very anti-Muslim Brotherhood, as you said. But even Mohamed Morsi, the previous government, Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood, even though he eased, I think, at certain times, the movement of people through Rafah, you know, even he didn't you know, simply throw open the Rafah crossing, right?
It's true, and you have to remember, Matt, that when Morsi was in power in Egypt, Hamas didn't really need the Rafah crossing. The civil population in Gaza, of course, wanted it to be open because they would like to have the ability to go into Egypt and get whatever they want from Egypt, whether it's medical treatments or just, you know, to visit or to shop, anything that any normal person would like. But for Hamas, under Morsi's government, the crossing wasn't important because they had a whole network of tunnels going from Egypt into Gaza. Very extensive, very sophisticated tunnels that were used to smuggle goods into Gaza, also smuggle weapons and rockets.
Right.
And the Morsi government didn't really do anything about it, so Hamas was comfortable with the situation. They actually made money from it. The border crossing was not in full activity, and the tunnels were going crazy, and they didn't need the Egyptians to open it. But when Sisi came to power, as part of his fight against the Muslim Brotherhood and against terrorism in the Sinai Peninsula, he destroyed the entire tunnel network between Egypt and Gaza, and suddenly the border crossing became a big issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in Gaza in 2012 and actually wrote a piece about the tunnels. I was in Rafah and actually, you know, went down into a few of the tunnels, and as you said, it was absolutely
amazing. It
was this huge, expansive network. I mean, literally with, you know, flatbed trucks backing right up to them in broad daylight to load out, you know, all kinds of goods. You know, some of them as innocent as soft drinks, and I'm sure, you know, I mean, much more, you know, worse things like weapons, in places not so public. But I think, you know, the easing the closure was an element of the 2012 ceasefire, right?
That's true.
So I think what you said, all of what you said about, you know, the Rafah being less important for Hamas earlier when they had the whole smuggling network open makes a lot of sense. You know, but it's still, I think, worth noting that, you know, an effort to ease the closure has been a goal of theirs for a long time and was a condition of the 2012 ceasefire that was not really implemented.
That's true. That was a big problem in 2012, that there were many things agreed, but not all of them eventually came into place.
Yeah. So let's move now to your article. You and Ben Birnbaum wrote a very good, a very well-reported, very deeply reported article for The New Republic that posted a couple weeks ago, looking at the whole, you know, the saga of Secretary of State John Kerry's efforts to reach a Palestinian-Israeli peace agreement. It's just over a year ago now that those talks kicked off here in Washington. I think it was July of 2013. And he initially set some fairly lofty goals, hoping to achieve an agreement within 9 months. And as you write, those goals became more modest as time went on. So, you know, I have a few things that I'd like to bring up about the piece. But if you would just take a moment and describe, you know, or just talk about what you think are some of the main takeaways or some of the most interesting things that your reporting showed.
Well, first, thanks for the compliments about the piece, which Ben Birnbaum and me really worked on for a long time. My main takeaway was actually something I could have said before we got underway with this investigation, and that is, this is just so complicated. We talked to almost 100 people who were involved in the talks, Israelis, Palestinians, Americans, and others, and each person doesn't just give you the stuff they know, the information, but of course every person who was involved in this, even at the most minor levels, has a very big interpretation about what happened and their ideas and thoughts and conclusions. And we heard almost 100 conclusions about what happened during the talks, why they collapsed. And it's very hard to filter it through and get to the point where you say, okay, this is really what happened. We tried to just, in our report, which is almost a 10,000-word report, really just put the facts out there and let people make their own judgment. But one thing, it's very clear, and that's that John Kerry came with a lot of good intentions, but along the way made a whole lot of serious mistakes.
So, I mean, what would you say were the biggest of those mistakes?
Well, the first mistake that eventually had the biggest implication was that when Kerry, last July, when he was stitching together the deal to start the talks between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Abbas, wasn't very careful with the details. He came with a lot of force and, like I said, a lot of good intentions, and he really cares about this. In Israel, usually the politicians, including Netanyahu, they compliment him for caring about Israel and being a big supporter of Israel, a big friend of Israel. But you hear the same kind of stuff from the Palestinians, saying he's a very serious man, he really wanted to solve this problem, he understands that the Palestinians are suffering under occupation. So he came with a lot of good intentions, and he got to the point where both sides are trusting him. But then he miscommunicated a lot of small details between the two leaders. We explained it in the story. There was one thing with the prisoners that Israel agreed to release. He thought that the Israelis were going to release 100 prisoners, like the Palestinians wanted. The Israelis actually agreed to about 80. Then there was an issue with settlements. He thought that the Israelis are only going to build about 2,000 settlement units. It turned out that they built almost 13,000. And when you come into such a complicated issue that so many great statesmen have dealt with in the past, you cannot be reckless with the small details. And I think that's a big lesson that any future American Secretary of State should learn.
And I have to admit, I was surprised by that. I mean, for someone as, you know, who has been around the block as many times with regard to diplomacy, as John Kerry, although not as Secretary of State, you know, someone who's been in government, who is a senator, who is a very prominent senator in foreign policy, for many years. You know, the fact that Kerry, as you described, would sort of kind of hear what he wanted to hear and then just say, okay, we've got this dealt with, and then move on, knowing as he should have, you know, how definitions and sort of agreements, you know, the difference between, you know, settlement building and announcing settlement plans and the announcement of tenders and all these different, you know, words that mean different things in an Israeli context, but perhaps not in a Palestinian context. I found that quite surprising that he wasn't attuned to that, or at least someone on his team wasn't attuned to that. Do you agree?
Yes, Matt, but you have to remember, that's another striking detail. When John Kerry began his Palestinian-Israeli odyssey, he didn't really have a team. That's another striking detail. He came here with a lot of force and won the trust of those leaders without a real expert team. And I remember that at the time, some of the experts on the issue here in Israel who met him and Frank Lowenstein, his aide that was accompanying here, they said, these guys are very nice and very committed, but they are not the kind of Martin Indyk or Dennis Ross experts that have dealt with this issue for their right. entire career. And they were surprised that Kerry is coming here with such a small team. And actually, a lot of them discounted him because they said he doesn't have any real expertise on his side. And they were surprised. They had to take their hat off when he eventually got Netanyahu and Abbas to agree. But it seems that this actually helped him, that he didn't play by the old rules. But it also hurt him because he didn't have somebody like Indyk by his side who could tell him, you know, Secretary, why don't we just watch the small details here for a second?
Yeah, right. And so when by the time Indyk came on, it was sort of too late to go back and address those misconceptions.
Exactly.
But, see, you know, what you said makes a great deal of sense. But, see, this is one of the reasons why I was so surprised by the piece. I think it was the interview with Nahum Barnea in Yediot, you know, with the anonymous U.S.
Yeah,
official,
sure.
Which I think everyone sort of assumes was Martin Indyk.
Yeah, of course.
In which the U.S. official expressed surprise that the settlements ended up being such a major sticking point. I mean, I'm surprised that anyone who was familiar with this issue or this process would be surprised.
I have to agree with you. And, you know, Netanyahu answered that interview by the anonymous American official by giving an interview to Jeffrey Goldberg and basically saying the Americans knew exactly how much we're going to build in the settlements.
Yeah.
And from what we found out in our report, based on basically accounts from both sides, that's true. They knew exactly how many tenders Israel was going to publish. They didn't know about the long-term building plans, but as you can see, I agree with you, Matt. I can't understand why anybody would be surprised that this is such a tough issue for the Palestinians.
Right. So, I mean, going through, you know, the piece, I've got a few notes here, just a few of the things I wanted to bring up. I mean, one of the things you talk about is, and this is an area that I was particularly interested in, because I actually thought this was a very smart move by Kerry, was the Allen assessment. General Allen's assessment of Israel's security needs in the West Bank, with particular attention on the Jordan Valley. It was the biggest and most comprehensive assessment of its kind ever done by the United States. You know, Allen spoke to, you know, a whole range of Israeli security officials and seemed to get a lot of them on his side. You even note that Avigdor Lieberman, you know, looked at the plan and said, this is the best we're ever going to get on this issue. But still, Netanyahu was hesitant, and more, you know, perhaps just as importantly, Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon completely rejected it.
Yeah, so after trashing a bit about Kerry and his team, I have to say that on this issue, they were very smart, highlighting the security issue, because that's Netanyahu's flagship issue.
Right.
And they put a lot of smart work into it. But I do think there was a problem with their... say assumption that if you get Netanyahu on your side on security, you can get him to agree to whatever you present on the other issues.
Yeah.
Because the truth is, Matt, that on security you can never get enough. There is never such thing as complete security.
Yeah.
And we see the same thing right now in Gaza, when Netanyahu, after Israel destroyed more than 30 attack tunnels that Hamas built into the Israeli territory, is telling the Israeli citizens, very frankly, there is no 100%. You cannot know for sure that there's not another tunnel dug underneath some kibbutz near the Gaza border right now.
Right.
And trying to get Bibi to say, I accept this security plan completely and this addresses all my needs, I think there's it's some kind of a trap, because you can never satisfy him 100% on security.
Right.
And what happened eventually, and that's something that we touch in the piece, but maybe not enough, is that eventually the talks about security in the Jordan Valley dragged on for a much longer period of time than what the Americans expected.
Yeah.
They built an amazing plan. Everybody who saw it, not everybody, but most of the Israelis who saw it really liked it. And what happened is that Netanyahu and D'Alon started really filibustering about it for every small detail here and there, fighting over really small stuff. And it dragged on and on into January when they thought that by that time they would already be discussing the partition of Jerusalem.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a good segue. You know, from my own talks with people, with Israelis, Palestinians, and Americans, you know, Jerusalem was, you know, perhaps, if not the thorniest, one of, along with refugees, the toughest issues. It's been understood that way for a long time. But what I'd heard from people was, you know, the lack of, you know, top-level thinking on the Israeli side that's been done around the issue of Jerusalem. Does that reflect what you know?
I think that on Jerusalem, it's a big mystery. Nobody really knows where Netanyahu stands on that issue.
Yeah.
Because at the time, back in, let's say, October, November, December, and that's something we mentioned in the piece, he suddenly stopped talking about it.
Yeah.
He gave a bunch of speeches, some of them really focusing on the Palestinian issue, and he didn't say a word about United Jerusalem or capital that will remain united. And then one veteran American official tells us, it's amazing, we are sometimes analyzing what this guy isn't saying.
Right.
Starting to make assumptions based on it. And to this day, it's not clear where he really stands on the issue, because in the framework discussions with Kerry's people, he was very stubborn about Jerusalem. He said that he's not going to accept any kind of formula that even hints at the partition of the city.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that deep down inside that's where he really stands. This could be more of a political issue. He just fears that if he says anything about Jerusalem, which is so sensitive, the right wing in Israel will desert him in 1 second.
Yeah. I mean, the issue of the Jewish state, and I think you talk about, you know, a formula that was developed, you know, possibly trading recognition of Israel as a Jewish state with concessions on Jerusalem. And how far did that actually get?
The Jewish state actually is one issue where Netanyahu made some kind of concession to the Americans. Mm-hmm. Because at the beginning of the talks, he had this very clear formula, Israel is the Jewish state,
mm-hmm.
Which it's a problem, because that has a lot of implications, as you know, about the Arab citizens and also about the Palestinian narrative. And the Americans preferred the kind of language that appears in the Geneva Initiative,
right. This
Israeli-Palestinian civil agreement from 2003, right. That basically talks about two nation states for the two peoples who live in this land.
Right.
And Bibi, at some point, actually accepted that kind of language into the American framework. And the framework doesn't include the words Jewish state, but it does include the words nation state of the Jewish people.
Right.
And that's, from his point of view, a concession. Of course, for the Palestinians, it was far from enough, because Abbas made this a flagship issue of not accepting the Jewish state thing. And, you know, Matt, I heard from a number of people who were involved in the talks, not in the first circle of the talks, but around it, that basically thought that if Netanyahu would agree to compromise on Jerusalem, Abbas would compromise on the Jewish state, you know, J for J kind of swap.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure the Americans really played that card seriously.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because that's I have a very similar impression from my own conversations with people, with Palestinians and Israelis. And I, you know, when I was over there in February, and I wrote a piece about this, you know, speaking to the Palestinian pollster Khalil Shikaki, who mentioned polling that had been done around the time of the Geneva Initiative, I think it was, or it was around, you know, the Roadmap Geneva Initiative era, so that's 2002-2003, which showed majority Palestinian support for that mutual recognition. Two states, two nations, mutual recognition as part of a final status deal. But what he said, and what I think is I heard from others as well, is that once Netanyahu kind of picked up the issue of recognition and sort of kind of elevated it to this core issue, and he did use that word, core issue, I think the Palestinians, based on their past experiences with Netanyahu, sort of kind of stepped back and said, okay, what's the trick here?
I think that that's one very smart option. Another option, and, you know, we're all guessing here, because getting into Bibi's mind is something that really the best minds of our generation have tried and failed. But another option, and I think, you know, this is maybe something that Bibi is raising, because he knows it's a kind of an easy Palestinian concession. It's something that the Palestinians can give Israel, because Bibi, from his first term in office, has this mentality of, if they give us, they will get from us. In Hebrew, it's itnu yekablu, if they give, they will get. Yeah. And what can the Palestinians give Israel? Seriously, we need to give them independence from the occupation, to give up our control of East Jerusalem, to give some refugees the ability to come into Israel.
Yeah.
And of course, from the international law kind of prism, that's all things that just Israel has to do, because the occupation is against international law. But from the point of view of the Israeli public, we're making concessions here. And what are they giving us in return? And then Bibi raises this issue of recognizing Israel as the nation-state of the Jewish people, and they can give it to us. And I think from Abu Mazen's point of view, and again, this is playing psychology, guessing, maybe he's saying, if this issue is so important to Bibi that he talks about it in every speech, then I'm not just going to give it to him. I want to get something in return. I could have agreed to this in the past with somebody like Olmert, who didn't make a big issue about it, but if this is so important to Bibi, then he's going to have to give me something back for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to hear that's his thinking, because, you know, from my own sort of perspective here, it seems that Abbas could have played that much, much, in a much smarter way.
I agree.
You know, saying precisely that, listen, if you think this is a core issue, okay, what are, you know, what else are you willing to give? I mean, you say it's so important, you should, if you say this is like one of the key defining issues of this conflict, then I should be able to get quite a bit in return for that, for the recognition. But it never really got to that point. I mean, you know, again, going back to your piece, one of the things that you talk about is that both sides, you know, both the Israelis and Palestinians, you know, you had negotiators, you had, you know, Abbas, who basically went against his entire cabinet in order to re-enter talks. And on the Israeli side, you have Netanyahu, who is very skeptical, but you also have Tzipi Livni, who's very supportive. So in a sense, you have these negotiating teams, very interesting personalities on both. I think the Livni-Mulho relationship that you write about is very, very interesting, with Mulho, who's Netanyahu's lawyer, right? That's his relationship.
Yeah, he's a lawyer very close to Netanyahu, and he's actually doing this for years. He's been negotiating on the part of Netanyahu with the Palestinians for years, and he's doing it pretty much voluntarily. He doesn't get paid for it most of the time. I think he enjoys it in a way. It gets him in the news as well. But yeah, he's Bibi's complete confidant.
So, yeah, but you have a situation where you have these negotiating teams who are negotiating largely without the support of their governments. I mean, yes, nominal support. They're obviously there in the room, so there's a level of support. But acting in a context of deep, deep skepticism from their own governments. I mean, everything else considered, you know, not the most, you know, promising context for moving forward, right?
I agree. And, you know, when I asked, for example, I did an interview with Tzipi Livni, not for our New Republic piece, but for my day job at Walla, and I asked her about this back when the talks began, and she told me, you know, I don't care about that. I don't care about the skepticism. I don't care about people being so pessimist about it. That's actually good for me, because nobody expects anything, and there are low expectations, so you come into the negotiating room and you can get results, and there's no pressure on you to prove anything. It's the other way around. Everybody thinks you're going to fail, so maybe you can succeed. But I think, at least from Mulho's side, you could really see through the piece how much, when he's representing Netanyahu in the room, he's taking into consideration Netanyahu's political constraints.
Yeah.
There's this one scene that we wrote about when basically Indik puts a map on the table while Mulho goes to the bathroom, and when he comes back, he's enraged to find out that there's a map on the table. There was another scene that we eventually didn't include in the story because, you know, in those kinds of magazine stories, sometimes good stuff gets left out. Mm-hmm. When basically the negotiating teams are sitting and talking, And Indic raises this some idea that Moshe objects. So he turns to Livni and he tells her in Hebrew, we cannot do this, this is not accepted, this is not something that, that can be done. And he's explaining, of course, this from Netanyahu's point of view with coalition and political considerations. And then everybody else is kind of embarrassed because they don't understand the Hebrew. And then Indic breaks the ice and he says, well, Itzik, Moshe's private name, just said this is a great idea. And everybody laughs.
Yeah, well, you guys, maybe you guys need to release a director's cut.
Maybe a DVD feature.
Yeah, that's right. The special feature, the special extended version. Let's see, what did I want to get to next? Oh, I have it written down here. I did want to mention the awesome line you had about Ericot being a political Swiss Army knife. Playing all these various roles.
I think that came from Ben.
Yeah, okay. That was pretty awesome.
Very creative mind.
So I think as we sort of get toward the end of the discussion here, I wanted to look at where we are now. I mean, and two things. One is things that Netanyahu has said subsequently. I'm talking specifically about the comments he made several weeks ago, where he said that, you know, what's happening in Gaza demonstrates that we can never withdraw from the West Bank. And specifically, you know, sort of dumped on the Allen assessment, which, you know, some people, I've had discussions with people, you know, a lot of people, even people who are skeptical of Netanyahu, don't think that he shut the door on two states there. And I just don't personally see how that's a plausible reading. It seems to me that if he said Israel will never withdraw from the West Bank and specifically made a point to dump on the Allen plan, which included, you know, plans for an eventual Israeli withdrawal, I mean, I have a very hard time seeing how that's in any way consistent with support for a Palestinian state. How did you interpret those comments?
I think, first of all, you have to remember that with Netanyahu, things change. Last week, just an example, last week, everybody here in Israel, including myself, I admit to my maybe professional failure here, but I'm not alone, everybody here was talking about how Israel is going to withdraw from the Gaza Strip unilaterally and the operation in Gaza without any agreement with Hamas.
Yeah.
And that's what we, the journalists who cover Netanyahu's office, were hearing.
Yeah.
And then comes Sunday, 72 hours later, and suddenly an Israeli delegation is going to Cairo, and there are negotiations between Israel and Hamas through Egyptian mediation, and Israel is looking for a ceasefire agreement with Hamas. Yeah, also with the Palestinian Authority, but with Hamas.
Right.
And that's just the kind of changes that you see in Netanyahu's time in office, and anything is plausible in a way. But I agree that when he said... and what he said specifically, he was talking about the situation in Iraq was the extremists that are just doing crazy things there as we were talking. And he said, today people understand why I did not give in to Kerry and Allen's plan that Israel withdraw its forces from the Jordan River. And certainly that puts a lot of pessimism, but still, you have to remember that during the negotiations, he did make some concessions with the Americans. He never gave up on the Jordan Valley thing, and I don't know, maybe there is a way to get the two things to work together, but I have to agree, today, like you, I'm more pessimist about anything good coming after this Gaza operation.
So, you know, finally, with regard to the Palestinians, you know, one of the things that really, you know, the talks were sort of tottering on the edge of breaking apart with, you know, the holdup on the release of the prisoners. I think this was late March, early April, and then the announcement of another tranche of settlements, and then finally Abbas's signing of several conventions, international conventions, that really just completely collapsed the talks. I think it was an interesting choice of conventions and organizations that the Palestinians, chose to join, a way of sort of getting a political boost, but not doing too much damage. But now there's talk of, you know, they're considering, you know, joining the ICC. My own view is that the Palestinians see this much more as a much more useful threat than as an actual, you know, following through. So what's your take? I mean, where do you think they're going to go from here?
I think that basically Abbas has given up, that's the kind of sense I'm getting, he has given up on negotiating with Netanyahu, not with Israel, but with Netanyahu. He doesn't see any future in that. And he likes the international arena. You know, during the work on our story, I heard one fascinating explanation for his actions from somebody very close to him. And again, that's one of those jewels that didn't make it into the piece. But basically, that Palestinian advisor, we can say, Abbas, said that ever since 1974, when Yasser Arafat, who was at the time the leader of the Palestinian resistance, ever since he accepted the two-state solution in 1974 for the first time, it was a solution that Israel was really against. Israel didn't like the two-state solution. The United States didn't support it for a long time either. So the Palestinian position of a two-state solution for many years was something that the Palestinians supported as a way to resist the Israeli occupation, as a way, and it was done against the American and Israeli position.
Yeah.
But ever since, the two-state solution has become something that even the most right-wing Israeli prime minister is calling a necessity for Israel's future. Then suddenly the Palestinian street doesn't see it, you know, as a way of resisting the occupation. The two-state solution has become, in the minds of many Palestinians, part of the Israeli occupation.
Yeah.
And by going to the UN and to the ICC and to other international organizations against the Israeli will and against American policy, Abbas is making the two-state solution part of the resistance again.
Right.
He's telling people, I'm resisting Israel and I'm even resisting the Americans, but I'm doing it through the international arena, not with terror. And that's an interesting explanation for his actions. He's committed to the same ideas, but he's advancing it in a way that looks like resistance and not like cooperation with Israel and the U.S.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Well, thanks for taking the time. It was great talking with you.
I enjoyed it, Matt. Thanks for having me.
And again, congratulations on the piece. Look forward to more of your work in the future. And anyway, I'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks. Take care.